So, we are continuing our stroll through the Fifth Way, which is the book I wrote, on the journey to the journey. This is about the journey that a modern Westerner must take if you're ever really going to sit at the feet of Jesus and understand what he was saying from an Aramaic point of view. For those of you who are here for the first time, Aramaic is the language that most scholars believe that Jesus actually spoke in day-to-day interactions. He may have spoken other languages, but Aramaic was the one that was the street language of the people. And so to make himself understood to them, he would have spoke in their language, in a context, and idiomatically as they would understand. And so if we're going to understand what he was trying to get across to us, we need to step into the sandals of those first hearers. Impossible to get inside of Jesus' head and understand his first intent, but we can understand what those words that he spoke would have meant to those first hearers, and that's what we're trying to do. And this involves a complete rehaul of our worldview. To be able to really step into the sandals of those first hearers, we have to think somewhat like them. Doesn't mean we're going to stop being modern Westerners, but to become an ancient Easterner just enough to be able to get into this mindset, to be able to let the deep, deep understanding of phrases and concepts and words sink into the place that they actually start to change our attitudes and our outlook, is a journey. So there's a journey to the journey that Jesus is talking about, and that's what we're trying to take over these last few weeks that we've been going through this. 2-3 weeks ago, we started a section of the book that is called Understanding the Misunderstanding. Basically, you can't take any major word of Christian theology at face value if you want to move it back into this first century Jewish understanding. The big words like good and evil and heaven and hell and faith and sin and forgiveness, all these words have different understanding and different meanings. So we're taking pairs of them each week, each chapter, going through here to try to understand. And if we can retool our thinking on these 6 major pairs of words and concepts, it's almost like a decoder ring. You know, the thing you used to get in the cereal boxes? You can decode the rest of the New Testament in terms of understanding what it was that was really being talked about. And why do this? Why is this so important? You said in here before, do you need a degree in foreign languages and theology in order to have a relationship with God? Absolutely not. Of course not. But if we're going to use the scripture as our guide and as our means for moving into that relationship, and especially if we're going to start hanging church law on that interpretation and understanding of scripture, then it becomes really important. And the single most important aspect is that Jesus' good news is based on an absolute unconditional love of the Father. And everything that we understand as Westerners chips away at that good news, because we look at life through a legal lens. The Pharisees of Jesus' day had come to look at life through a legal lens, and that's what he was fighting so hard against, to get the people to understand that it's not about legality. It's not about rules and following. It's not even about obedience. It's about moving into a residence that he called kingdom. It's moving into a quality of life that sees the presence of the unseen Father as real, as palpable, as anything else that we can see or measure with our senses. And when we get to that place, when we are resonating with the King, when our will is literally the same as his, because what we desire, what we take pleasure in, is exactly what the Father desires and takes pleasure in, then we look like the law. Last week we said, as in Deuteronomy, the law is written on our hearts. We're not obeying anymore. We're doing what we please. And we look like law. We look like relationship. We look like kingdom. Because now our impetus is the same as God's. We desire those things. So that's what we're doing. We're kind of going through these pairs of words. Today it's good and evil. All right? We're going to talk about good and evil today. Can't even take that for granted. Darn. You know? Good and evil has different understanding in the Aramaic. So let's talk about that for a second. I wanted to start here. I was talking to a woman a while back who is really struggling with relationships, realizing that she kept circling back to dysfunctional relationships over and over again, and she really couldn't help herself. Her relationships became, in effect, like a drug is to an addict, where she couldn't help herself. She became powerless, even though she wasn't thinking in a 12-step mindset. And when we have, through the conversation, what it finally came down to is she started to realize, either then as she was saying it out loud or had realized before, that she really didn't believe that she was worthy of being accepted, of being loved. And so that fear, that afraidness of not being able to have another relationship kept her coming back to the dysfunctional ones. It's simple. It's everybody's story to a certain extent, don't you think? I hope you can all resonate a little bit with that. Realizing that at root, we're all insecure. At root, we're all wondering if we're good enough, if we're going to be able to measure up and really have someone who's going to care about us. And ultimately, is there a God? After this threshold we call death, is there something or someone out there that is going to take our hand and guide us and care about us and love us? That's the existential fear of all of us as human beings. What I started to talk to her about was some of the research that Brené Brown has done. And I don't know if y'all are familiar with Brené Brown. She is a sociologist. She's a researcher. She comes from a completely secular point of view. But the beautiful thing is that she ended up right at Kingdom, whether she understands it that way or not. She did 10 years of research with people, and through interviews and letters and compiling all of this data on people's lives and relationships, what she started to realize is that people fall into basically two groups. The first group are people who can have good, connected, and solid relationships. And she realizes that we're here and everything about human existence is about connection. That's what we're about, is connection. And there are a group of people who could do that in their relationships. And there was a group of people who couldn't. And the line between the two was shame. Now, the way she defines shame is revealing. She defines shame as the fear of disconnection. So it's the fear of disconnection, just like this woman I was talking to, the fear that she can't be connected, that she's not good enough, that keeps her and keeps anyone and all of us from having connection. And so if you take a look at the people who already have it, she says, what about them? What was the defining characterization of them? What did they have? And she found what they had was the courage to be imperfect. The courage to be imperfect. In other words, they could let their imperfections show. They could be open and transparent just as they were, as imperfect as they were, without feeling that they had to fix something in order to be in relationship. And further, as a corollary to that, she also said that they believed that what made them vulnerable made them beautiful. Think about that for a second. Those two characteristics. The courage to be imperfect, and the feeling that what makes you vulnerable makes you beautiful. Now, I think it's ironic that when you think about the closest people that you know, the people that you're closest to, are they perfect? If you're close enough to them, you know that they're not. But you love them anyway. And I'll wager you this, that the things that you find most endearing, the things that you find most affecting to you, are going to be their eccentricities, their weirdnesses, the goofy things that they do, the things that they do wrong. Those are the things that endear us to each other. Anyone that you imagine is absolutely perfect, how close a relationship do you have with them? They're so far up on a pedestal, you know, you're not even close at all. And you can't be close to a person that you think is perfect, because as soon as you get close enough, you realize they're not. And so the irony is that we spend our whole lives trying to erase the imperfections in order to be connected, which are the very things that make us connectable. We're working at cross purposes. And so I was trying to get this across to her in words. And of course, I said, ultimately, you know, it's not about words. It's going to be about experience. But maybe if you can start to reframe this thing, you can start moving in another direction. And then she asked the $64,000 question, of course. How do I get to the point that I feel that I'm worthy? How do I get there? You know, and that's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about how it is that we get to the point that we feel worthy. And this, for our purposes as modern Westerners, flies in the face of our notions of good and evil. Because we think of good and evil legally. We think of good and evil as polar opposites on some sort of scale. Whether it's a legal scale, whether it's an ethical scale, a moral scale, there's some sort of scale, some sort of way that we gauge these things, and good and evil are up there. And so it's all about performance. It's all about measuring up. You know, it's all about hitting those standards in order to be good or to be judged as evil. I wanted to read you a little bit from the fifth way in this particular chapter, because I think it's important for us to try to get into the mindset, into the flow of maybe what, at least in our imagination, first century Jewish life was like. So as I read this, maybe even just close your eyes and try to let it wash through you a little bit and see if we can get into that space, because kind of slowing down and letting things open up is part of the deal itself. It's not hard to imagine Yeshua. And I think I want to pronounce his name the way Aramaic speaker would, Yeshua, as opposed to Jesus. So it's not hard to imagine Yeshua as a small boy spending uncounted hours in his father's carpentry shop, watching and helping and eventually working there himself, possibly taking over his father's business before he set off on business of his own. See his little form perched safely out of harm's way as he watches the raw lumber come in and the slow, painstaking, even organic transformation taking place before his eyes, with only the roughest of hand tools being applied. See his smiles as he begins to understand his father's patient intent, parts of living trees becoming fine and finished additions to the homes of his friends and neighbors. The process is not quick, and each piece is a custom original, lovingly and skillfully coaxed out of the heart of the wood. Yeshua was no son of a fast-paced urban merchant, but of a rural craftsman, embedded in the rhythms and agrarian life in the Galilee. These rhythms, this submission to and participation in the natural cycles of life all around, became part of Yeshua's vocabulary, a storehouse of images and stories on which he called to communicate word of his kingdom. These are the images that abound for us in the Gospels. Ordinary stories of ordinary people doing ordinary things. Yeshua speaks of widows and farmers and vineyards and wedding celebrations, of fishermen and servants, tax gatherers and sometimes kings, but always within the course of daily life that everyone recognized and experienced. The people of the first century Galilee, just like people living today in agrarian and subsistence cultures, were intimately connected with the rhythms of nature, of the turning of the globe, night and day, circuit of the moon through its phases, the slow progression of the seasons, the movement of wind and weather and wildlife. They lived close to the earth. They could hear its heartbeat and depended on its pulse for their very lives. To be in harmony with the land's rhythm was certainly good. It was critical to maintaining their lives. When to sow, when to reap, when to go out on the water, when to come in. A good crop was a ripe crop, white and ready for harvest, one that had been planted and carefully tended and completely in harmony with the seasons and the land. To be outside such harmony was not only bad, it could be disastrous when the success of a single crop could mean the difference between life and death. Yeshua tells the story of a farmer sowing seeds that fall on good soil and bad, on rocks in the beaten path. Though the deeper spiritual meaning of his parable had to be explained, everyone immediately and intimately understood the implications of seed being planted in the wrong place at the wrong time and of plants dying off before becoming mature and ripe and ready. We as modern industrial people don't understand this anymore. We can spend years of our lives completely isolated from the rhythms of nature, in hermetically sealed, air-conditioned cars and houses, never seeing a sunrise or a sunset, our bare feet never really touching the earth, even electrically isolated from the ground by rubber-soled shoes. We no longer see the quality of our lives being intimately tied to and dependent upon moving in step with the beat of the earth's heart. So our understanding of good and evil are no longer based in concepts of harmony and timeliness. These words mean something else entirely, something as completely isolated from the rhythms of nature as we ourselves have become. For us, good and evil are moral terms, dealing with the quality of interactions and behavior in human affairs, or qualities that meet or fail to meet certain moral or legal standards. They are terms that describe the intrinsic nature of a person as viewed against those standards by which that person is judged acceptable, appropriate, desirable, or not. Languages reflect the cultures that create them And so for us in the West, as the children of Greek philosophy and Roman law, good and evil are at root legal terms. We judge everything around us and each other according to the standards of law. And consequently, we feel judged ourselves according to those same standards. When Yeshua said at Matthew 7, "Judge not, lest you be judged," he was saying exactly that. Not that God would someday judge us in retaliation for judging others today, but that in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. If we judge another according to some standard in our minds, we have already judged ourselves. God has nothing to do with it. If you think about it, the reality that we believe is the reality we endure. Do you get that? Put that one on your fridge. Think about it for a while. The reality we believe is the reality we endure. We don't experience reality directly. We experience it through the filter of our worldview and what we already believe. And so if we have a standard for judging, if we have a legal view of life, then that's the way that we're going to see life and relationship. And that's the way we're going to see ultimately our relationship with God. That it's all about laws. It's all about obedience. It's all about standards and how we perform. And our acceptance is based on that. And whatever standard that we use to judge others and to judge our reality has already been applied to us. We're already living that nightmare, I suppose you could say, because it's already something that we believe ourselves. And these standards, by and large, for us are legal. And you can't see God and you can't see God's love through a legal lens. The legal lens automatically is about balancing scales. It will take out this whole nature of God's love, which is not just at core. It deliberately unbalances the scales in favor of the beloved. And so from a legal point of view, no one is ever acceptable enough, desirable enough. There is always a standard that is out there someplace that we're chasing like a horizon. It's always moving. It's always going. So how in the world are we ever going to see that we are good enough? Good and evil we look at is these polar opposites like light and dark, which is a euphemism for us for good and evil. We see them in this dualistic way as these absolute opposites that are always in conflict with each other. But as we talked about light and dark before, the Aramaic vision or version is a continuum that moves across. And light and dark are necessary energies. Darkness is seen as the curved energies of wind and water, whereas light is seen as the straight energies of the sun. But each one of them is necessary, and it completes the whole. Just like having nighttime for assimilation and for dreams is necessary to be able to go back out in the day and do the things that we need to do to accomplish. And so there are complements. They're necessary opposite sides of the same thing, if you want to look at it that way. And that gives us a clue to the way the Aramaics, the Jews, looked at good and evil. Good, taba in Aramaic. Literally, if you go right to its roots, it means ripe. And from that reading from the book, you see, the reason that the highest good that a people could ascribe in an agrarian society like that is something that's ripe, something that preserves life. If the crop doesn't go ripe, if it doesn't produce edible food, the people die. And so the highest good is something that is in harmony. It's ripe, it's mature, it's ready, it's in the right place at the right time. It's flowing seamlessly. That is what good means to this people. And when Jesus says taba, when in his teaching, where you see good in the New Testament, the Aramaic word standing behind that is taba. You have to understand that the people would understand it this way. Not as a moral standard, not as a black and white, binary, dualistic way of looking at life, but as this whole in harmony, connected in place, in time. And so the opposite of that, bisha, evil, means unripe, of course, immature, out of place, out of harmony, out of rhythm, out of time. And even in Hebrew, we have tov and ra, good and evil. One scholar has defined those or translated those as functional and dysfunctional. Pretty good. Same idea. If something is functioning, something's good if it is able to, has the capacity to operate to its design specifications, if you want to look at it that way. If it can do that, it's good. If it's not doing that, it's bad. And so all of this idea here, you know, this idea of goodness, a good person then in our thoughts is someone who abides by a standard, whatever that standard is. They do lawful things. They do good things in terms of doing good deeds for other people or whatever we have defined as good along our standards. But to an Aramaic, a good person has nothing to do with behavior. Huh? A good person is someone who has matured enough, someone who has become ripe enough to see the goodness in unity, in relationship, in oneness, in harmony, in being at the right place at the right time, of being present so you know that all these things are in place as they should be. A good person who is one who can see that, and because they see that, all of their actions follow suit. It's like we were talking about before. Jesus' notion of kingdom is exactly that. That everything in your being is resonating with the King, resonating with the Father, so that everything you do flows from that center place. Now, this may seem like a subtle difference to you. I don't know. And from the outside looking in, a person who is following the law real well and a person who is Taba, who is in kingdom, they may look just about the same. But from the inside out, it makes all the difference in the world. Because one is just following rules, obeying. And maybe like a dry drunk, they're gritting their teeth through every day and every minute of it. But the other person is flowing, is in the best possible place they could be, having the best time that they could ever have. And so we have to see that there's a difference here, you know, about having matured, about having grown into someone who is in love with life, basically, in love with unity, loves being one with, connected with, and would never do anything to harm a relationship because they love being in relationship so much, the right place at the right time. Not a subtle difference at all if you're looking at it in terms of the lived experience of our lives. And when that takes place, where is that sense that we're not good enough for relationship now? To be in love with relationship, to be willing to do what relationship demands, which is vulnerability, opening up, taking down the defenses, that all becomes possible. And so again, bad or evil is not doing bad things, but it's the inability to see the goodness in life, the inability to see the unity of all things, to be so unformed or damaged that you're incapable of being able to do what it takes to have this kind of relationship, this kind of connection. Remember when Jesus said from the cross, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing"? That is literally true when you think of good and evil from an Aramaic point of view. They don't know what they're doing. People who are bisha, people who are unripe, can't even see what is right in front of them. They can't even see the relationship that they're missing. They can't even see what they're doing is causing the dysfunction. They're usually mystified, as we've all been. God, why does my life get any better? Why does everything keep going the wrong way? Why do these things keep happening to me? You know? It's kind of like Charlie Brown. You know, why is everybody always picking on me? But the reality is, they're creating that reality for themselves. But they just don't know it. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Now, all of this is not to excuse bad behavior. Please understand. You know, we are still personally responsible. But it gives us an insight into the way that God looks at us. Because we know how much we mess up. We know how imperfect we are. And it's so hard for us to imagine that anyone could approve us, let alone God. And yet if God is looking at us in this way, on this continuum from unripeness to ripeness, and everybody is someplace along that path, I mean, how much do you blame a 1-year-old for having to mess their diapers up? We understand they're just not capable yet of being able to use the potty. We know that. God knows that about us too. He can look at our lives. How can God love us when we're so unlovely? How can God love us when we're doing all of these things? It's just like when we look at a 1-year-old who is still messing in their diapers. We understand. God can understand these things. It gives us this insight, this way of looking at how God can love us. There was a time several years ago, a woman called me and asked me if I would visit her son at Santa Ana Central Jail. He had gotten popped for possession and distribution of heroin, and he was having a really rough time in there, so she asked me to come and visit him, and I said, sure, I would. And I don't know how many of you have been to Central Jail to visit someone, but it's kind of a surreal experience. Yeah. There's all of these rows that are all glassed in, and from the visitor's side, it opens on rows that alternate, and then the alternating rows are open to the jail side. And so you walk into this row, and there's just rows, two rows of seats with little dividers looking at the glass with a handset, a phone handset. And on the other side are all the orange jumpsuits coming in. Jumpsuit. So I was standing there waiting for my orange jumpsuit to show up. And I looked a couple of spaces down and I saw a young woman talking to a man in an orange jumpsuit. But as I watched and I looked at her and I looked at her eyes and I looked at her body language and I couldn't hear what she was saying. But in my way of thinking, she could have been across a white tablecloth with candles in a restaurant. You know, all she saw was her man. You know, and the intensity of her expression and the intensity of what you're saying and the obvious love that she had for him was absolutely orange colorblind. She did not see the jumpsuit. All she saw was her man. You know, what do you think that did for him? Sitting in that place to be able to look through that glass and see this woman who still obviously had this love for him and had this presence for him. See, this is the point. If we can start to see good and evil from an Aramaic point of view, we start to realize that the Father is orange colorblind too. He doesn't see our jumpsuits. He just sees us. He looks at us. He looks right through all that stuff. And he sees the person, the Taba person, the ripe person, still trapped inside the Bisha shell, inside the unripe shell. He can see that. And he can love us through our unlovely phases. And if we start to realize that, if we can break down the fear and the risk of becoming open and vulnerable and transparent in our moments, we shall start to realize that we see those loving eyes coming back at us in the midst of what we feel about ourselves. Line up enough of those experiences and you start to realize, I am worthy. How do you do this? You got to start someplace. But maybe the someplace is right now getting a different picture about what good and evil are about and the way that God looks at us as Jesus looked at us, the way he modeled for us. That'll give us a clue that maybe it's safe enough to drop my shields, to open up, and to see if those eyes are really there for me on the other side of the glass. If you take a look at so many of Jesus' saying and you substitute the words ripe and unripe, or mature and immature, for good and evil, it starts to really do something to the meaning. And I wanted to take a look at just a couple of these and see if we can drive this point a little further home. At Matthew 7, starting at verse 15, it's in your bulletin, so you can take a look upstairs there. Jesus stutters, apparently. Beware. Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor a bad tree produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then, you will know them by their fruits. Well, that sounds pretty judgmental to me. I don't know about y'all. But take a look at, starting with verse 17, if we paraphrase, if we take those goods and those bads and put them into an Aramaic context, how does it change what we're talking about here? Every mature tree bears ripe or beautiful fruit, but the tree that is not ready bears unripe fruit. A tree that is ready cannot produce inedible fruit, nor can a tree that is not ready produce edible fruit. Every tree that does not bear edible fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Every tree that does not bear fruit that nourishes, that preserves life, is cut down and thrown into the fire. Why? Because it's not doing what it's designed to do. It's just taking up space. What's the difference here? When we take a look at the one, we take a look at the second. In the second one, when we put it into the Aramaic context, there are no more value judgments. It's just a statement of fact, you know? Either the tree is ripe and mature and ready, or it's not. Either it produces fruit that is edible and ripe and delicious and juicy, or it doesn't. It's just a statement of fact. And if it doesn't, well, then it has to be gotten rid of so we can make room for something that does. It's not about absolute intrinsic nature. It's about this production that takes place. The whole purpose of the law to the Jews was to preserve life, to preserve the community. That was good. That was really good. That's what justice is for. And so the same idea is here. It needs to produce. It needs to produce something that produces, that preserves life, that is something that is good, if it has the capacity to preserve life, to fulfill the intended design. Take a look at Matthew 7 a little bit later in verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. And now many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name cast out demons and in your name perform many miracles? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness or wickedness or iniquity, can be translated there. What is Jesus saying here? Behavior has nothing to do with acceptability. It's not about all the great things you do. It's not about all the great things you don't do. It's not about behavior. It's not about performance. It's not about these standards. It's that we must be ready. We must be mature enough to be vulnerable enough to be intimate. We hide behind our actions and our busyness, don't we? When we're too afraid to be intimate, don't we just get really busy and do a whole bunch of nice things, take out the garbage, do this, do that? Because that's easier, that's safer than what it really takes to be open and to be intimate. But how many marriages function along that way, but there's no there? Both of the spouses can say, I never knew you. This is what Jesus is talking about. This is what the Lord is talking about. It's not about all these things you do. Have you got to a place? Are you ripe enough? Are you ready enough to risk being vulnerable enough to know me? That's it. So different. And not only that, to put even a finer point on it, this word here for lawlessness, those who practice lawlessness, when I first looked that up in an Aramaic lexicon, do you know what the first entry was? A baby or a suckling infant? Huh? And you know what the next entry was? A colt, a baby horse. And then the third entry was lawlessness, wickedness, or iniquity. Each one of those words within that same root, that's why they show up in the same spot in the lexicon, are all related to each other. What in the world is the relationship between a baby, a suckling infant, a colt, and someone who practices lawlessness or wickedness or iniquity? They're all immature. They're all unripe. None of them can perform to their design specifications. The baby can't do what an adult is supposed to do. A horse can't pull a cart. And someone who is lawless or wickedness cannot see the value of relationship or be able to do the things that relationship requires. It's beautiful the way the Aramaic, the way the Hebrew root and pattern system pulls all these meanings together so that we can get a clearer idea of what is really being expressed. And this last one, Matthew 5:48. Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. How many people have stayed up late at night worrying about this one? How in the world am I supposed to be perfect? You know, it either fills us with dread or it goes right over our heads because Jesus must be saying some kind of sweet platitude here. That's not really literal. He couldn't possibly mean it. Yeah, he means it. That's one thing about Jesus. He means what he says. And if he tells you can do something, you can take it to the bank. He's not just playing metaphors with us. It's what I've found in all of these passages. But we have to understand what the words mean. Gamira, which is this word that is translated as perfect, has nothing to do with being without error, being mistakeless. It has nothing to do with that. You know what it means? It means complete. It means whole. It means mature. It means ready. It means fulfilled. It means ripe. It's the same concept. So think about this. You can be perfect in the midst of making mistakes. You can be ripe in the midst of error. This is what Jesus said. We will always be making mistakes. We will always be in error of something. But what Jesus is saying, at the same time, you can be fulfilled and complete and whole because you are ripe enough to see the value of relationship and unity. And even as you fall short, you are still working toward that. That's okay. This is what Jesus is trying to get us in order to be able to understand. It's not this legal anxiety and stress all the time. We can relax. We can move into these things. We can see our imperfections as they are, not debilitating our relationship in any way. So critical to be able to understand this. We can be as ripe as Father, seeing goodness, seeing unity all around us, even as we're making our mistakes. And we can still be perfect. We can do this. So what does this look like in real life? That's what I always ask. You know, it's great to get all these concepts, but what does it look like? Is anybody modeling this for us? Can we see what this is supposed to look like? You know, sometimes you just got to be ready for truth coming from unexpected places. Frank sent me an article just yesterday that was posted by a pastor who used to work here with us on Facebook. And he said, you got to read this. And I did. And I was surprised because it comes from Stephen Colbert. Do you know Stephen Colbert? The comedian, humorous, satirist. You know, I've watched a few of his reports, Colbert Report or whatever, and I wasn't really impressed. Didn't really like his brand of humor. But there is a depth to the man that obviously doesn't come through otherwise. And so I just want to read you just a little bit of this article. And just listen. It's an amazing story. It turns out that Stephen Colbert has a sign on his computer that reads, "Joy is the most infallible sign of the existence of God." Is that cool? Joy is the most infallible sign of the existence of God. No joke. I tell you this by way of context for what comes next. GQ ran a profile on him this month titled "The Late Great Stephen Colbert." The article is jaw-dropping. What starts out with a story about Colbert needling Eminem on a public access show in Michigan soon takes a turn, and all of a sudden Colbert is dropping assertions like people's suffering is sacred. We've heard Colbert talk thoughtfully and even beautifully about his Catholic faith before, but never this close to the bone. In fact, I'm not sure it gets any closer. Stephen is the youngest of 11 kids. When he was 10 years old, his father and two of his brothers, the two closest to him in age, were killed in a plane crash. Young Stephen was the only child still at home with his mother in the years immediately following. The article eventually gets around to the question of how it could possibly be that Colbert suffered the losses he suffered and somehow arrived here. It's not just that he doesn't exhibit any of the anger or open woundedness of so many other comedians. It's that he appears to be so genuinely grounded and joyful. How did this happen? Here's a quote from the article. He snapped his fingers and locked eyes with me in a pose of dramatic intensity. And he said, "My mother." His face softened. "But the answer is my mother." Then he lifted his arms as if to take in the office, the people working and laughing outside his door, the city and the sky, all of it. "And the world," he said. "It's so lovely. I'm grateful to be alive, even though I know a lot of dead people." The urge to be grateful, he said, is not a function of his faith. It's not that the gospel tells us and therefore we give thanks. It's what he has always felt, grateful to be alive. And so that act, that impulse to be grateful, wants an object. That object I call God. Now, that could be many things. I was raised in a Catholic tradition. I'll start there. That's my context for my existence. It's that I am here to know God, love God, serve God, that we might be happy with each other in this world and with him in the next. That's the catechism. That makes a lot of sense to me. I got that from my mom and my dad and my siblings. He was tracing an arc on the table with his fingers and speaking with such deliberation and care. I was left alone a lot after Dad and the boys died. And it was just me and Mom for a long time, he said. And by her example, I am not bitter. By her example, she was not. Broken, yes. Bitter, no. Maybe, he said, she had to be that for him. He has said this before. That even in those days of unremitting grief, she drew on her faith, the only way not to be swallowed by sorrow, to in fact recognize that our sorrow is inseparable from our joy, is to always understand our suffering, ourselves, in the light of eternity. What is this suffering in the light of eternity? Imagine being a parent so filled with your own pain and yet still being able to pass that on to your son. It was a very healthy reciprocal acceptance of suffering, he said, which does not mean being defeated by suffering. Acceptance is not defeat. Acceptance is just awareness. You got to learn to love the bomb, he said. Boy, did I have a bomb when I was 10. That was quite an explosion. And I learned to love it. So that's why, maybe, I don't know. That might be why you don't see me as someone angry and working out my demons on stage. It's that I love the thing that I most wish had never happened. I love the thing that I most wish had never happened. I asked him if he could help me understand that better. And he described a letter from Tolkien. Tolkien was the writer of The Lord of the Rings. In response to a priest who had questioned whether Tolkien's mythos was sufficiently doctrinaire, according to the church, since it treated death not as a punishment for the sin of the fall, but as a gift. Tolkien says in a letter back, "What punishments of God are not gifts? What punishments of God are not gifts?" And Colbert knocks his knuckles on the table. "What punishments of God are not gifts?" he said again. His eyes were filled with tears. So it would be ungrateful not to take everything with gratitude. It doesn't mean you want it, but I can hold both those ideas in my head. So Colbert is taba. Colbert is right. Who knew? Amazing. You know, from a legal point of view, his experience as a child was evil. It was bad. It was horrible. You could be raging at God, raging at the universe. How could this happen to good people? What kind of God allows this to happen? To wipe out three family members just like that? Is it a punishment? Is it a correction? Is it a discipline? We think that way, don't we, from a legal point of view, the bad things that happen to us. I've seen it printed in church documents. I've seen churches teach it from the pulpit. You know, when these things happen to you, it's God's punishment or it's God's discipline or God's correction. What kind of God does that? We call a person who does that a monster. What do you call a God who does that? Is that really what is going on here? Because from an Aramaic point of view, from a taba, from a right point of view, what Colbert is saying here is that he can still see the loveliness of life and feel the urge to be grateful even in the midst of the pain. And he can see how the pain has led him to a place, through his mother's example, to where he can be who he is now, someone who is ripe, someone who is taba. And he doesn't do this because the gospel told him to. He's not obeying anything. It's the goodness, it's the ripeness, it's his ability to see that is allowing him to act this way, authentically, naturally, intrinsically. He got to the point that he could come to love the thing that he most wanted never to happen. Because even in the midst of the pain, even in the midst of the grief, he can still see the loveliness, the connection, the unity, the love that persists through this all. And so now if we can get to the point that we are ripe and we are ready, then I guess the only question to ask is, what punishments of God are not gifts? Can we see life that way? Once you do that, everything transforms because you have transformed from the inside out. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this. Thank you for the example. Thank you for reminding us at least reminding me to always look for truth wherever it comes and not where I expect it to be. Thank you for Colbert and his example. Thank you for reminding all of us that we can turn this thing around, that we can look at life in a different way that will help us to move through into this unity, into this kingdom, into this intimacy that you have been storing for us and living for us and modeling for us. Father, we love you imperfectly. We love you. We want to become more and more right, more and more perfect each and every day. Help us to do that. Help us to lay down the things we need to lay down and risk the things we need to risk to get closer to you today, right here, right now. Thank you for loving us. And help us to remember we only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.